You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. If you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You also get ad-free versions of every episode of the podcast. We're currently working on a bonus episode about what we watched during our month-long hiatus. You can find it all at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps,
Genevieve Kosky,
and Tasha Robinson.
This week, our gin is your tonic. We have two visually dazzling fantasies inspired by Arabian Nights, where genies offering three wishes are merely the tip of the magical iceberg. But before we get into this week's pairing, I'd like to use my power as a podcast host to grant one cinematic wish to all of us. If you could ask a genie to do something movie-related for you, what would it be? Genevieve Kosky.
Well, my wish would be to see something that I've seen happening in video games translate over to movies, and that would be a spider warning for those of us with arachnophobia. I really could have used that for this week's pairing in particular. Keith, what about you?
Okay, so I kind of, when this came up, I find myself going through the stages that one goes through when one gets a wish, which is like, oh, I know exactly what I want. It's like, well, wait a minute, can I go bigger than that? So the big one is like, restore all the lost films, right? All the silent films that are no longer around or whatever. But my first thought was, I want to see Orson Welles' cut of The Magnificent Ambersons. So that's my that's my movie wish. And I have a hard time seeing how that's going to have like a monkey's paw, like, side effect. Tasha, what about you?
Oh, man, I kind of went to the same place of, you know, well, here's the obvious wish. But I think that there are a lot of things that a cinephile could hope for in terms of, you know, on a really small scale. I would like Chicago to bring back their downtown summer movie series where you had 8,000 people just like sitting in a field together watching the same movie. That was big fun. Or I like that you're going to bring back all the lost movies because that was kind of on the list. I would also say make all of those movies like freely available streaming online because there's just so much stuff that's been lost. But I think ultimately, if I had to pin it down, it would be a pretty selfish wish, which would be, you know, like a little private movie screening room where when you go inside it, time in the outside world stops for you. Because for me, you know, the big problem with watching movies is time. There's never enough time. And there's so much I want to see. Short of just giving me a whole bunch of extra time or, you know, giving me some kind of monkey's paw immortality that would have me outliving my friends in a very depressing AS Byatt kind of way, I'd say just like a place where I can go, you know, when we enter a movie theater, time stops for all of us. But I want that to be literal.
Tasha, wow. But you know what's going to happen when you go in that room, right? Your glasses are going to break and you're not going to be able to watch.
Fortunately, I have like literal boxes of contact lenses. Very rarely fall on the floor and drop.
We haven't thought about the potential backfiring wishes, which is that every other Orson Welles film gets destroyed, all the negatives.
Not the man who can see tomorrow.
My fairly violent fantasy is to have all of the digital projectors ripped out of all of every projector.
Oh, Scott.
and then destroyed in an environmentally sound and safe way. That would be nice. But I think I would just rather kind of turn back the clock to the moment where everything was still screen in 35 millimeter and the Blu-ray was kind of the right format. Like that's the sweet spot there. Film in theaters, people watching stuff on Blu-ray. Just not laser discs. There. Not laser discs. Those aren't good.
I know. What about 4K Blu-ray?
Sure, sure. But I mean, like, again, I'm talking about going back in time. Please, Keith. I'm talking about going back in time here. Nothing fanciful like 4K Blu-rays weren't around at that moment. God. Anyway.
I like that all of us have additive fantasies that bring new and exciting and wonderful things into the world, except Scott, who's just like, destroy everything I don't like.
Yeah, I think that would make it... Yeah, I'm sure there's some sort of genie backfiring thing. Well... We can wish for what we want movies to be, but on this show, we have to contend with what movies actually are. What have we got this week, Tasha?
The new George Miller fantasy, 3,000 Years of Longing, takes place largely in a hotel room in Istanbul, where an academic who specializes in storytelling enters into a conversation with a djinn that emerged from a bottle she acquired in a bazaar. The stories the djinn tells her about his millennia of adventures are rooted in the Middle Eastern folk tales often referred to in English as Arabian Nights. This gave us the opportunity to look back on one of the most technically ambitious fantasy films ever made, producer Alexander Korda's 1940 spectacle, The Thief of Baghdad. Released a year after The Wizard of Oz, the film used breakthroughs in technicolor and special effects to bring candy-colored palaces, magic carpets, and, sorry Genevieve, giant spiders to life, influencing modern blockbusters from Raiders of the Lost Ark to Disney's Aladdin.
So on this episode, we'll talk about The Thief of Baghdad and how it raised the standard for cinematic fantasy. And the next week, we'll bring in 3,000 Years of Longing, which tries to infuse the genre with adult themes on life and love. Please stay with us.
Come with us on a ship of adventure to meet the Thief of Baghdad in that ancient land of mystery, romance, thrills, and excitement. Baghdad, city of magic. Baghdad, where breathtaking miracles leap before your eyes. There was a rich and powerful king in Baghdad. And there was a lovable little thief.
When darkness falls, leave your palace, go among your people, mix with the crowds.
Then fate threw together the powerful king and the little thief on the road to strange adventures.
I often think about what it must have been like to be a child going to the movies in the late 30s and early 40s. To see the first full-length animated feature, Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, followed by Pinocchio and Fantasia a couple years later. To see the sepia-toned Kansas turned into a full-color dreamscape in The Wizard of Oz. And then to be treated to the wall-to-wall spectacle of 1940's The Thief of Baghdad, an adventure that doubles as a dazzling demonstration of what the still-young medium could do. This was a time when movies were rapidly developing. Only 2 years after Warner Brothers popularized the new three-strip Technicolor process with the classic swashbuckler, The Adventures of Robin Hood. The dream that George Méliès once had when he ran a capsule into the moon's eye in 1902's A Trip to the Moon was being realized as quickly and thrillingly as ever before. The impossible was becoming possible. 82 years later, The Thief of Baghdad still has that enchanting power, even as special effects have grown infinitely more sophisticated over the intervening decades. At the time, producer Alexander Korda seemed to recognize the need to strike while the iron was hot. The Thief of Baghdad had been made into a hit before in 1924 as a silent vehicle for Douglas Fairbanks, who considered it his favorite of his films. From the bones of that project, Korda recognized the potential of applying new advances in technologies and techniques to the classic folktales of Arabian Nights, staging fantasy adventure on a scale that audiences had never experienced before. Though Korda had produced or directed many classics in Britain, including Things to Come, The Private Life of Henry VIII, and The Four Feathers, which was kind of a warm-up for The Thief of Baghdad, the stakes were high for this film, and the production was tumultuous. Korda burned through several directors, including the great Michael Powell, and patched together the film despite running out of money and having the outbreak of World War II suspend filming until it could be resumed in the United States. But little of that behind-the-scenes drama is evident in the finished product, which is a testament to Korda's persistence of vision, and of the outsized roles producers like him and David O. Selznick could have in a movie. Given the many hands involved in making The Thief of Baghdad, it probably helped to have a story that breaks up so well into smaller stories, held together by the unlikely friendship between an exiled sultan and a joyful young thief. though the conspicuously British actor John Justin is the ostensible hero of the film as Ahmad, a blind beggar who was once the ineffectual ruler of Baghdad, the film belongs to two performers who make much deeper impressions. Conrad Veidt as the evil advisor Jaffer, who uses his sinister magic to seize power throughout the kingdom and beyond, and Sabu as Abu, a thief who is the son of Abu the Thief and the grandson of Abu the Thief. Before Ahmad was a blind beggar on the streets of Basra, he was the highly suggestible young sultan of Baghdad, acting as a puppet for his sinister advisor, Jaffer, who has turned it into a miserable and unjust city. When Ahmad finally discovers the truth by disguising himself as a commoner, Jaffer arrests him and seizes the throne. That's when he meets Abu, who's thrown into the same prison for thievery, but seems unfazed by it. The two escape and flee to Basra, where Ahmad becomes obsessed with a beautiful princess whose sultan father is known for his prized collection of toys. Jaffer arranges to marry the princess in exchange for a mechanical horse, but at this point, the princess and Ahmad are in love. So Jaffer blinds Ahmad and turns Abu into a dog. And that's only the beginning of a grand adventure that's full of wishes and curses and other supernatural events, including a hot-tempered genie in a bottle, a giant spider, an all-seeing eye, and a magic carpet ride. The Thief of Baghdad is full of stunts and gorgeous matte paintings and experiments in visual effects like rear projection and blue screen. But the casting of Veidt and Sabu are perhaps the most important effects of all. With his unshakable confidence, loyalty, positivity, and rascally sense of humor, Sabu is an especially winning screen presence with a childlike spirit that sets the tone for the whole film. So what would it have been like to see The Thief of Baghdad as a 10-year-old? Who knows? We can only watch it now as grown-ups 82 years later. Does it still have the same power to enchant? We'll talk about it after the break.
Years ago, King Solomon, master of all the jinn, imprisoned me within that bottle. For me, this is the first moment of my new freedom. For you, this is the last moment of your life.
My life?
Your life. In a moment, I shall lift my foot and crush you. Insect, beetle, worm that you are.
But chief of spades, I fished you out of the sea. You opened your bottle, I let you out. You can't be so ungrateful.
Ungrateful? Slaves are not grateful. Not for their freedom.
So I'm curious, how does it feel to watch The Thief of Baghdad as a grown-up? 82 years later, and not as a 10-year-old in the year 1940. Were you able to be transported by it? Or could you kind of, you know, see the threads?
I mean, I kept getting transported to being a 10-year-old watching Disney's Aladdin, which draws so much, both visually and sort of in its characterization of certain people, not to mention Abu, the character being Abu the monkey. I don't know.
And Jaffer being Jafar.
Yeah. And like even like sort of the eyes, like the stare, the magic stare is very reminiscent of the Disney Jafar. I don't know when it became Jafar and not Jaffer, but other than that, it's pretty one-to-one. But
Ahmed's vest is also very much like one Aladdin. I mean, we weren't trying to hide the source of inspiration with that one.
No, not at all. But this was my first time actually with this movie. And like, yeah, you certainly can see the strings of some of those effects, but you know, some of them are cool in spite of or even like because of those. I really enjoyed the flying horse sequence, or really sort of the assembling of the horse leading up to the flying was very cool done. And like, honestly, that spider was a lot scarier than a lot of like gnarly CGI spiders I've been subjected to over the last decade or so of films. So, you know, it definitely still has power to affect.
Yeah, I mean, yes, you obviously can see the strings a lot here, but I'm on the record with liking old effects, even if they've been technologically superseded. But, you know, it's kind of like fun seeing how the magic trick is done. Yeah, obviously that's a big, like, cast of a foot, not a giant, a realistic looking giant foot, but it's still really fun to watch. And I think some of those effects are just, you know, I wouldn't change a bit about them. Like I love the genie. The genie is really cool, and the sense of scale, the way they play with scale when he's climbing the canyon and things like that, it's really ingenious and really effective, and takes me into the world. Yeah, I like the movie a lot. I had not seen it since I was, I don't know, 12 or 13 or something. And, you know, now I'm even more aware of how influential it was. You know, Raiders comes immediately to mind, but just really a whole school of adventure films. It is a proto blockbuster in many ways. It was good and bad too. It's also very much a film built around the set pieces, you know, and you kind of wait to get to the fireworks factory and from time to time, but it's not you have to wait too long. It's nicely done that way.
Yeah, this is kind of the 1940 equivalent of a Jurassic Park movie, isn't it? And, you know, and that Jurassic Park Dominion is a movie that exists much more for the dino scenes than anything else. And here you can just kind of feel like the narrative only really cares about, like, where are we going to go next? And, like, what big, interesting special effect thing are we going to do?
Except I did care, though. And I really think the performances, you know, particularly Conrad Veidt and Sabu, are really riveting and exciting. You know, it's just, how can you not just be like, you know, and I found the friendship between Abu and Ahmad to be really winning. You know, I mean, it just, you know, they really kind of have this great connection that gets forged in the prison. And I think Ahmad responds so well to Abu's spirit and his confidence and his just the sort of the breezy way he goes through life, and I think that's irresistible to him, and I think it's irresistible to me too as a viewer to kind of like connect to a character like that. And just he's just got one of those faces and that just what the movies are made for. It's just like, so he's just such a striking performer. He's got all kinds of physical gifts, he's got all kinds of comedic gifts, and I think that takes you so far in terms of putting you through the movie, getting you through the movie when it's not, you know, so set piece oriented. And it is a very set piece oriented movie, but those stretches in between are filled with a lot of stuff I like too, because of some of the performances.
Really? I thought the performances were kind of the weak part of the film. I mean, I don't think Sabu is a very strong performer in a lot of ways. He's very shouty. Like, he physically throws himself into the character in a very realistic way. And I really like the way he's structured and characterized in a lot of ways. But I saw the seams in this movie way more in the 1940s style acting and the kind of feeling of people not necessarily being in the same space during shooting than I did with the special effects.
I mean, I agree with that overall, but I don't necessarily agree with it in terms of Sabu as Abu. And I was so much more charmed by John Justin being charmed by Sabu than I was any of the sort of like romantic stuff happening between Ahmad and the princess, oh, yeah. which does feel very much in that sort of heightened of this era style of acting, you know, or very swoony, I guess, and it's not really like based in anything resembling actual human emotion.
It's also like the romantic scenes in a Marx Brothers movie. It's kind of like, yeah, let's just get through this and let's get back to the Marx Brothers.
Except.
But it's also a little bit like a fairy tale, you know, it's right. To some degree, it's like, you know, Les Mis or stories like that, where it's like, here's the ingenue couple. We know this has to happen. We don't want to spend too much time on it. So they see each other and they're like, hey, the first attractive person I've ever seen in my life of the opposite sex. Let's go for it. It's all good. But I appreciate that the film both shorthands it and just kind of makes it a little soppy. Like, it's kind of adorable. Abu cares about Ahmad's obsession with the princess, not because he believes in undying true love, not because he thinks they're tyrannous for each other, but because this is in the way of, like, all the exciting, fun things he wants to do. So he's like, all right, you're obsessed with this lady. I can get you in to see her. No big. Then we're going to go hang out with Sinbad, right? Just over and over and over. Like, structurally, I maybe had a minor problem with the degree to which their whole story is about the inevitably the kid of color exists to support the white guy in his extremely soppy desires and futures. But I cannot hate a 1940s film that's basically about how the Indian kid is competent at literally everything he does. And his irrepressibility and his confidence and his skills get them both through life. Whereas that handsome white guy just kind of stands around being bland and waiting to be rescued. I thought that was pretty fun.
It's the booze movie. I mean, he's the star of it. I mean, yeah. the prince or the king or whatever, but you know, it's the booze.
That's true. It is called The Thief of Baghdad, not The Prince of Egypt.
I have a couple of notes, a couple of responses. one is that, again, I have to stick up for Sabu's performance here because I think it's fantastic. And I think, you know, in question, I mean, did you all not enjoy Sabu giving the business to the genie? That did not entertain you? Or because I found that stuff to be hilarious. He's just it's that kind of like that spirit of his, that sort of sense of humor that, you know, I just think he just embodies the whole spirit of the film. Like I don't see it working. He's like, it's just that piece of the movie that if it's cast with someone else, it could seriously damage the film. I mean, I think Sabu is a really important part of the movie. And then the other thing I will stand up for is I think the last kind of big scene between Ahmed and the princess, where they're both sort of chained up in prison, is actually really good and really kind of passionate and kind of weirdly erotic too, because they're sort of tied up and, you know, and the stuff they're expressing to each other is very intense. You know, I think that, you know, for a movie that doesn't really want or even need or to spend the time to establish that relationship, to fuss over that relationship much, it sells you on it at that moment. I am kind of a sucker for, you know, movies
bondage scenes.
Yeah, I do like that. Well, of course, but then also I like movies that believe in love at first sight to a degree. I mean, I like I don't mind Sleeping Beauty being not a film of great psychology, because you're just supposed to feel that connection, and that connection is made through the cinema. And I think that kind of is, you know, this movie doesn't make that connection as strong as I would like, but it does in that moment. It does finally when they're in prison together. I think, I mean, I felt it. I felt like it felt very urgent, and I was kind of surprised by the power of it. And I got a lot of that is in the staging.
I think the staging in that sequence is really neat. I think the way she's, you know, tied up against this dramatic, spiky backdrop, like dark backdrop of a wall. And she's got this like very bright white costume with these very bright blue cords tied around her. It's like a movie poster image. And then the way he's chained up is also just like very, very contrasty. Like the space that they're in is very dark and heavy. And then they're both very visually light characters. So I like the visual staging of it. I like what they say to each other. I think there's a romanticization of like their tragic death there. That's the best they can do in a scenario where they can't be together. That's very brave and feels like maybe the most heroic thing they do in that movie. So yeah, I'm all in with you on that scene. As far as Sabu and the genie, like that's taken pretty verbatim from short stories that I'm familiar with and I like. And I don't love the execution. It's very strident. It's very broad. It's very yelly. I will trade you for that, though. The scene that maybe really sticks with me in terms of Sabu's performance is when the genie just kind of dumps him in the god's temple and leaves him to navigate it on his own. And Sabu is clearly frightened and out of his element. But I'm calling him Sabu instead of his character name. But Abu is unnerved, but he rises to the occasion. And like watching him fearfully navigate this space, find a way to arm himself, and then the whole sequence where he climbs up the spider's web, where he starts singing to himself, like a little reprise of his song from earlier with new verses, and then goes to climb up the spider's web. Like, I thought all of that was great. And in part, it's because he's not projecting personality loudly at somebody else on screen to convince them of something. He's not, you know, shouting everything he does. It's a much more internal performance where he is kind of trying to buck himself up in a very small, quiet way. And like throughout that sequence, which starts off like very internal and musical in a fun way. I really liked it whenever this movie veered into being a musical, although those segments are few and far between. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a big physical action sequence that he's really suited for on a pretty incredible set. So like that, yes, the whole sequence, I think, is great.
It is. I guess you could say, yeah, I mean, he certainly would be well suited to just a straight up silent film just because he's got that physicality to him. He's got that kind of outward expressiveness and he has so much strength, you know, and kind of, you know, he looks so cool in the light. He's just like so magnetic.
And like, as for the shoutiness, I mean, I guess I don't disagree with that description, but I also just kind of like consider it part and parcel of this kind of movie from this era in Hollywood. I guess it wasn't a Hollywood film, but in this era of movie making, like especially a quote unquote child actor, even though Sabu is like 15 or 16 at this point, but he is, you know, playing a character who is a child. And I think this is like, in a lot of ways, a children's movie, or it's a family movie at any rate. But I think like as far as, you know, what we were talking about with the love story and kind of how thin it is, it's notable that the final beat of this movie is not Ahmed and the princess, you know, living happily ever after. It's Abu jumping on his car being like, nope, I don't want any of what you guys got going on here. I'm going back to having fun and adventure and living my life the way that I love it. And it's a very, like, I think it's a very kid friendly ending, not like, ooh, gross, you know, kissing. So I guess I just sort of process that character as being very childlike, even though the actor is not necessarily a child, just the way that it's written and the way the film is sort of constructed around him, I think encourages that reading.
Yeah, the sequence before the big rescue sequence, where he finds himself in the land of fantasy, and they basically say, you've come here as an innocent child and your heart is pure and therefore you get to be king. Like that also is a very child fantasy. That's a lot of fun. Like here's your magic awesome stuff, which you get for being a kid. Now there's only one rule and you shouldn't break it. Wink, 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 wink. definitely don't jump on that thing over there and like go off to have fabulous adventures. Yeah. And then of course that's exactly what they want him to do.
I'm going to tell you what you need to say for this incredible thing to go.
Which you definitely shouldn't do. I think it's delightful that the former king of that place, who I guess the implication is that he also was a small innocent child and became king and then has lived out his days there. And it seems like he's also ready to go on to adventures, or he's very excited to see this kid who is very clearly going to take the carpet and go have adventures. Like the whole time he's kind of peeking through the curtains, like, all right, here he goes, breaking the rule I told him to do, because it wouldn't be fun if I told him he could have the carpet.
Yeah.
Like the psychology of that is fun. One of my favorite things in the movie, I think, is that monologue that Ahmad gives at the end that you can just see Abu piecing out on, where he's just like, after he goes to school for an inordinately long time and studies a whole bunch of math and other really boring subjects that you, the audience, don't care about, he's going to work really hard for a long time indoors while wearing the uncomfortable collar he's trying to pull off right now. And it's just like, it's not just foreshadowing. It's comedy, you know? It's outsized comedy in a way that I just found really enjoyable.
There's one other notable performance, but we will get to that after this break. Okay, we're back, and the performer, the major performance here that we haven't talked about really at all yet is Conrad Veidt's performance as Jaffer, and this is a bad guy. This is a bad guy. Like, you know, Aladdin had its Jafar, but I don't know if even Jafar, the Jafar of the Disney Aladdin was as diabolical as this one. This is a bad dude. What did you think of this performance and this character?
He was bad, but he also, you could feel for him a little bit, right? I mean, this is someone who is so alienated from everyone else. I mean, he is such a magnetic performance. It's not just, you know, it's not a simplistic character, even though given the choice, he always does the bad thing.
I don't know. He feels pretty unequivocally just bad to me.
Very hiss worthy.
And I guess what's interesting about him to me, and this is something that transferred over to the Disney version of the character, is that he's a sorcerer. You know, he has a huge amount of magical power, and we don't really have a lot of context for why he has it or how he obtained it and why the people he's using it on don't have it. I guess the implication is that he like learned and obtained it over years of study that maybe is what Abu was being pointed toward. But it's never really like clarified unless I missed something. So he does kind of like stick out from the other characters in having this, you know, kind of massive amount of power, I guess, other than the genie. And the fact that he wields it only for bad, I think just like amplifies his evilness. And as far as the performance goes, like I think Conrad Veidt does a very good job getting that across, not just the evilness, but sort of the power, the internal power, the idea that he has something inside of him that allows him to manipulate people, just like the hypnosis that he does on the princess. You know, like it, again, in Disney's Aladdin, it is translated specifically as like, you know, the whirling hypnosis eyes, you know, with spirals in it. Uh-huh. But here it's just like, that's what Conrad Veidt does with his face. And it comes across as him performing sorcery. And that's impressive.
Yeah, well, the key light plays a part to there, too. Nice kind of like close-up, and you get that nice light across the eyes. Again, I mean, I love it. I mean, just anything you can do with a movie camera that affects it, like bring across things that don't have to be said is a big plus. But I'm kind of with you. I don't necessarily see a pitiable side of him. But what's interesting to me about him is that power... the accumulation of power is almost like the sole motivator, because you would think, for example, his interest in the princess would be about desire, but I don't even think it's that. I really don't, even given, you know, this is, she's a young beauty, of course. I don't really see any kind of like spark of attraction there. It's just about like, okay, this is territory I'm going to continue to claim. I'm just going to build up all of this power for what I don't know. It's just like this like mirthless accumulation of power. That's kind of what he's all about. And I like that. I like that the film plays it that broadly, and it plays everything pretty broadly. And I think purposefully so. Good and evil, I think, is really heightened in this film. And I don't mind it. I think it fits the genre quite well.
I guess for me, what sets him apart from Jafar and Aladdin is that Jafar is essentially a monster. You know, he's caricatured to the point where he is kind of just monstrous. And to see Veidt as a human being who's like so removed from anything that makes everyone else human, I don't know. It has a different effect for me.
I'm there with Keith. I mean, like, I don't think that he's a secret redeemable good guy or anything like that. But I do think that there's a humanity to him, like an aspect of him that isn't just cartoonish. That's interesting. As far as why he has magic when nobody else does, I think that that's just a case of coding. Like, I think that there's a lot of coding that goes into the sorcerer in a story where nobody else is a sorcerer except, you know, inhuman creatures like the djinn. I think it tends to connote, like, he's probably a scholar. He probably knows a lot more than all of the people around him, who mostly seem to be kind of dim bulbs anyway, sometimes in innocent, like, good ways, and sometimes in abdication of responsibility ways, like the Sultan of Basra. But I think there's also often an implication that, you know, he has powers that humans are not meant to have, that he's like therefore in league with the devil or, you know, some other malign supernatural force. I think that's all probably kind of understood in a story like this, is you have access to things that don't belong to humanity because you yourself are kind of outside of humanity a little bit.
Right. And I think that's where you can read more depth into his character, maybe not necessarily humanity, but like there is a story there, you know, like the fact that he is so separate from everyone else in this movie. It does make you wonder how he got there. You know, I don't want a Jaffer prequel or anything, but although having said that, like, there's probably a Jafar prequel for Aladdin, right?
Oh. Return of Jafar.
Somebody should send you a check. Cut your check for that idea.
You know what they have instead?
Yeah, I reject it. I don't want
Disney Plus series, Jafar. You misunderstood.
I regret putting that out into the universe.
It'll be like Wicked, right? He'll be like, it was everybody else who was bad, but Jafar.
No, it'll be like Maleficent. They already did it with Maleficent, which again, it's kind of the same type of figure. Yeah, you know, right. Like
nobody liked Maleficent, but it made $1 zillion and more or less like launched the, like, Alice in Wonderland was the theoretical launch of the Disney live action remake, but Maleficent was really the one that sealed it. Yeah. But in that same vein, though, like, I'm not a fan at all of the I think it's 2019. Live action Aladdin. But one of the things that it did that I thought was interesting was give Jafar a little more backstory and a little more motivation. Not like full Maleficent, but just like enough to make him not that cartoon character. Like, he at least claims that he comes from poverty in the same way Aladdin did and had to kind of like pull himself up. And it's clear that like learning nefarious magical powers was part of that for him, like tapping into this thing that maybe required him to give up some of his soul, but like it gave him an edge and a way to gain power in a way that, you know, people don't in systems like this that are very hierarchical and don't have a whole lot of mobility in them.
So I wanted to shift a little bit. We've talked a little bit about the effects, but they're a big part of this movie. So maybe we should dig in a little bit more. Did the effects work for you overall, and were there any particular effects that wowed you, especially considering when this film was made?
I feel like we talked about that a bit in terms of like the spider and the horse. I like the sequence Genevieve called out where they assemble the horse and it comes to life is very Wizard of Oz, like more than anything in the film that was reminiscent of Wizard of Oz for me. But honestly, the seams around things like the flying horse for me are so obvious that they're kind of distracting. What I found more impressive in this film was the pageantry, you know, the giant, brightly colored sailing ships, that ridiculous spider web that I called out that Sabu has to climb up. The setting itself of the temple with the goddess with the all-seeing eye and her forehead. Like, obviously, they do a lot of stuff playing with scale. But I thought the set piece where the beautiful princess is coming through and it's death to look on her, so everybody has to clear out of the marketplace in a panic, and then these like ferocious riders come through and just like shoot arrows at any part of any person they could see, and then eventually the princess comes through with her retinue. Like, that whole thing is filmmaking on a very large scale, and I found that all really a lot more impressive than like the rear projection stuff or the, you know, the genie and the little person running around at his feet kind of stuff.
Yes, you can see the seams in the horse, and that whole sequence with the toys, the Sultan of Basra's toys, you know, it's just sort of a symphony of the cutting edge effects of the day, all kind of put together in the guise of these toys that he likes, which we haven't really talked about the Sultan or that performance, but that is another one that is just like lifted directly into the Disney Aladdin characters. Uh-huh. Of Jasmine's father, right?
Honestly,
down to
this movie,
the mustaches.
That character made so much more sense for me than it did in Aladdin itself.
Yeah, just sort of this childlike dummy, but he's a little more sinister here. Like, there is sort of the sense that he has, as I think Scott said, like, abdicated his responsibilities in favor of this, you know, these flights of fancy, and that is damaging and not, you know, cute and quirky. So, and he does receive a pretty grisly death.
That's a great scene too, mm-hmm. with the six arm mm-hmm. lady, and then just the planting of the knife and everything. I just thought that was, it's kind of almost a little scary too, the way it unfolds.
And you don't necessarily have to sympathize with him too much, because he just talked about getting rid of his 365 wives so he could, you know, make sweet love to a robot instead. Yeah. You know, one of the things that makes him sinister is, like, it's been a while since I've seen the Disney Aladdin, but I don't remember the Sultan there talking much about his subjects and how disappointing they are. And, you know, how occasionally he has to, like, lop off their heads or whatever. Like, the Sultan here isn't just obsessed with toys. Like, he comes right out and says that he enjoys his mechanical toys so much more than the people that he's supposed to be ruling. Like, he makes it very clear that he's abdicated and that he has nothing but, you know, contempt and dismissal for the people that he's supposed to be looking out for.
So, like, even though, yes, you can, you know, see the seams around the effects in those toys, like, I really enjoyed that sequence because it's like kind of an excuse for creativity. You could kind of see, like, you know, the filmmakers, like, what can we design here that will allow us to make this toy feel magical practically? I enjoy kind of piecing together how those things work visually, even if I can see the seams. Like, the seams are part of the enjoyment because they allow you to kind of see how it works. But also, you know, going back to what we were talking about with just, like, the scale of everything, like, the early scene of Abu, like, running through the streets, you know, before he's caught, and sort of the one jump ahead of the bread line sequence, if you will. But, you know, just the levels and the depth of those sets, I'm assuming they're sets, and also the colors of them. Like, there's a sort of, like, pastel quality to a lot of the sets here that is not what I immediately associate with this milieu of filmmaking. You know, I feel like film set in this time or this sort of version of this era tend to, you know, go toward much deeper saturated colors. So it was interesting kind of seeing it translated in a different palette than I was expecting to see. Also, the garden was very pretty, and the sort of, it's not original, but the prince and princess sort of meeting via a reflection in a pond is just always kind of a nice way to, you know, find true love.
That was
cool. I do like their little garden banter. Like, he takes up the pretense of being a djinn pretty readily when it gets mm-hmm. him what he wants, but he drops it pretty quickly, and they do a little romantic pattern banter that's kind of the 1940s equivalent of that's our song. You know, she hears it later and she thinks of him when she might have otherwise forgotten him. It's a nice little callback and a nice little piece of writing.
Yeah, it's effects wise too. I think the genie and every effect with that genie, I think, is, well, except maybe the genie flying in certain sequences.
Yeah, I was gonna say that it's not as smooth.
I think
he looks like an old, like, Kenner, like, rubber doll figure on a string, just kind of like being dragged.
I love that, though. It's so charming. I mean,
it's charming,
you know,
but it is.
I kind of what Genevieve is saying is, even when it doesn't work, it works.
Yeah. But a lot of that stuff just works, though. Some of it just straight up works with the
regarding
genie.
The
I
genie
like that stuff.
And Sabu and Ahmed, to some degree, this movie has a lot of male skin in it. Like, way more than I'm used to seeing in movies of the time.
It's hot out there.
It's hot out there. And in here, am I right?
Sun's out, guns out.
I had a small just bit of enjoyment. Scott, you were thinking about what it was like to be a 10-year-old kid in the theater seeing this for the first time.
Yeah.
I was thinking about what it was like to be a 40-year-old housewife watching this movie and, you know, kind of fanning herself like, well, I've never seen thighs like that before.
It's got something for everybody. I can't imagine too many people were all that upset about the buxom princess being being tied up in the weird spiky prison place. But that's entertainment.
Speaking of entertainment, I'm the only person that's brought up the musical sequences. As I say, there are not a lot of them, but there are at least four or five of them. What did other people make of those?
I'm honestly struggling to remember them beyond Abu's song.
There's the song that the princess's handmaiden sings to her that's kind of the, well, we're women. We got to sit here and wait for the prince to come along and say those magic words song. That's, you know, it's how you entertain a princess that you're dragging back and forth on a swing. But the movie opens with a song about like men going off to sea and how clean and pure and wonderful sea is over the shots of those just like gorgeous Technicolor ships. And then Abu's got his song and then the reprise of his song.
Yeah,
I do like, if you watch the or listen to the commentary on this between Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, which they're both on it, they recorded it separately, but Scorsese talks about how Coppola enjoys singing that Sailors Going to Sea song just kind of on a fairly regular basis, and I think that kind of charming.
Yeah, that commentary track, I haven't had a chance to dig into it, but if you subscribe to the Criterion channel for streaming, it's one of the features on there. I actually watched the movie on the Criterion channel's website, and I found that first and was just like, this is real. It's a full feature-length Scorsese Coppola talking about this movie. That's amazing.
Yeah. Scorsese was so good at commentaries, but when he did them, I'm kind of anxious. I had forgotten that the two of them had done the commentary for this one, so I kind of want to go back and see it. I'm sure this movie hit them at a great time, because it would have been kind of, I guess, doing what some rep screenings here and there, and when they were growing up, they probably saw it at that impressionable age where it kind of blew their minds.
And Scorsese befriended Powell, so like he has a lot of stories about actually talking to him. And elsewhere, and like the bonus features on the other commentary, which I think Bruce Eder does, which is really good, he talks about how really there's not a lot of history about this film's production because all it's lost, and like all we kind of have is like Powell talking about it. But like, there's whole scenes that nobody knows who directed, whether or not Ludwig Berger, who was like the first director who's credited, like whether any of his scenes ended up in the film at all. No one knows. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of fascinating how something this, you know, this film this, you know, big and seen by so many can have so many mysteries around how it was made.
Yeah, it's just the power of the producer. I mean, Alexander Korda really kind of brought everything together. And, you know, I mean, the production was broken up. It just doesn't feel that way. It feels like a very coherent Feigian vision.
Well, to bring it back to what Tasha asked about, because we didn't really answer about the songs, but I did not have a strong reaction to them clearly. But I am curious in the context of what we're talking about, like, was this envisioned as a musical, or are those like artifacts of one director or another? Like, what do we know anything about why these sporadic song elements are there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I actually was reminded, I mean, Keith brought up the Marx Brothers thing earlier, but that was kind of an element of Marx Brothers movies when they moved from Paramount to MGM to make films like Night at the Opera and the Day of the Races, is that you would have, you know, some, you know, musical numbers, you know, between lovers that you don't care about, etc. It just was just an element that was kind of part of the big production
language
suit
of film,
yeah,
at the
total
time.
Total,
yeah,
entertainment package. Well, it's just a kind of a fantasy film thing. I mean, Korda talked about how one reason he made this film is like the only that after the silent era, there was a dearth of fantasy films that weren't Disney. And, you know, of course, Disney films, you know, music is part of those too, even if we don't think of them as musicals. I think it's kind of the same thing. I was saying with The Wizard of Oz, which came out a year before this, is probably one of the closest points of comparison. It's like, again, not a musical per se, but certainly takes it, you will pause and give you some music. You know, you paid for a movie ticket. You should get a whole evening's entertainment out of the movie you're watching, right?
Putting the mellow in melodrama.
Yeah.
So the Criterion essay for the film, Andrew Moore makes a connection between the Thief of Baghdad and sort of the colonialist point of view. And you can see how the film might raise that issue of how the West understands the East. I mean, there are notes of barbarism on one end and exoticism on the other. How do you see all that sort of manifesting itself here? And did any of it make you kind of uncomfortable?
I mean, one of the things that did make me uncomfortable is we haven't really talked about the fact that a great deal of the movie is somebody telling a story, which is something we'll get into, I think, in comparison with 3,000 Years of Longing. But our introduction to the man who tells that story is him begging for coins in the street, and he's just repeating the phrase over and over, almost for Allah's sake. I've never heard it pronounced Allah before, and it every single time it felt grating and strange, like something that you would get from somebody who has never studied Islam in any way, doesn't know anything about the belief, but understands vaguely that the kind of foreigners that you're making a film about in this exotic setting find this god Allah very important. And it just is such a strange melding, I think, of trying to be respectful to a culture that has certain elements of religion like threaded through it, and just not knowing the most basic thing about it. I found it very strange, and I kind of flinched a little every time somebody mentioned Allah, which happens a lot during this movie.
I mean, it is the definition of Orientalism in many ways. It is the exotic East, and it conflates the Middle East with South Asia, with East mm-hmm. Asia in terms of what you see. And
casting, like Sabu is Indian.
And, right, yes.
You know, there is just sort of a conflating of that area of the world. But that is, you know, as far as, you know, representation on screen, with this era of film, that's just something you kind of, it's part of the package. I mean, like, yeah. Uncomfortable with the casting, you know, like it's just, there's... You have to just accept it to be able to like take in films from this era, but you can still interrogate it.
Yeah. Really almost not like, I don't want to necessarily say, you know, come at it from, you know, 82 years later and say this is abhorrent, but it is interesting just to look back and see how the film reflects a colonialist point of view or reflects the sort of attitudes that Western filmmakers might have towards the East. And it can go either way, as I say. I mean, it is, you know, the East could become this place of broad fantasy Orientalism, as you say. And then there are other times of the film where characters from that region of the globe are seen as just are flattened. Their humanity is flattened in other ways too, and they're kind of faceless and vicious as well. Particularly kind of the guards, I suppose, towards the end of the movie, kind of struck me that way too. But it's interesting to kind of look at it as part of the movie, and it's something that is worth, I think, thinking about.
All that being said, I don't know to what degree this was intended as being coded or read as being coded at the time, but it's also a film that is, you know, is bookended by, and features throughout, the idea of an unjust government that needs to be overthrown, and Sabu's the one who overthrows it. I mean, I don't know if there's anything to be read into that or not, but it is there.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up as far as the colonialist viewpoint, like you could, if you want, take to task the degree to which like the common people are kind of superstitious and ignorant. Like they're easily led, they're easily permitted to believe the lies that Jaffer spreads. we don't really, the movie never really interrogates why they all believe Ahmad is a tyrant, like an evil tyrant. I think you're left to kind of like read between the lines and think that Jaffer's been ruling in his name and probably doing terrible things. I think you have to understand or at least expect that he's ignorant of what's being done in his name, or you can't take him as a hero. Like, it comes as a shock and a surprise to him to find out that he's considered a tyrant who men desperately want to see overthrown. But we never actually find out why that is, not just in terms of whether Jafar is doing things in his name, but like we never hear he's, you know, taxing us unfairly, or like we see one person executed for thinking, and I guess the implication there is that that's the kind of tyranny that we're facing. But yeah, in terms of, you know, the colonialist narrative, like even that is kind of placed within a cultural context that says to me that the writers did actually read the Arabian Nights, not just because of the things they steal from it in terms of like entire like specific plot lines pulled out, but also just in terms of like how people talk to each other, you know, the weird little expressions that come up from time to time, like Abu calling the king of the land of fantasy, like father of a beard, is just a very Arabian Nights kind of thing. And that sequence with the men all sitting in the marketplace, like listening to the storyteller, who is also kind of an imam, like leading them in a religious understanding of sorts of like the prophecy and how things are going to fall out in the future, like sort of fomenting revolution and preaching religion at the same time. Like that all strikes me as a lot more culturally cogent than most of the movies that you would have seen at the time.
And some other parts of this movie.
Yes.
So I think this will be a topic that we can revisit when we bring in 3,000 Years of Longing. But for now, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this discussion and anything else in the world of film. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net if you want to share any responses with us and other listeners, or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. We'll be back in a minute with some feedback. Now it's time for feedback. We got a couple of good letters from Jason and Austin, including this one on Grizzly Man, that questioned our take on a scene that we spent a lot of time unpacking in the episode. Genevieve, do you want to read an excerpt for us?
Sure. Jason writes, "My lone critique of your Grizzly Man take was how hard you came down on the scene where Herzog listens to the recording of the slaying of Timothy by the bear. It's certainly indulgent on Herzog's part, but I found the scene central to the story. As you pointed out excellently, Timothy saw himself as a mythological character. The idea of the lost tape, which must be destroyed or hidden, carries on that mythology beyond death. It creates the Holy Grail, the secret treasure, the Excalibur of Timothy's saga, the cursed thing which is too powerful and must be destroyed. But at the same time, it's very personal. It is all that to the lover because it would destroy her to hear the demise of the man that she loved. And she knows it might well have been her who got lured into his web and killed beside him. It's Timothy's own mythologizing of himself as a modern samurai warrior, etc., which lured Herzog into his story, and Herzog milked his mythology for everything it was worth. That's what makes this film transcend, in my opinion, and the scene with the recording is central to those ideas."
Okay, so as the person who was the primary and possibly only objector to that sequence, the thing here is that in describing what Jason feels is great about it, I feel Jason very accurately describes what I didn't like about it. The phrase "milked his mythology for everything it was worth" really kind of sums it up. And everything he's saying is, I think, accurate to what Herzog ends up turning this tape into. I think that this is a very lyrical and poetic description of it. But again, we're talking about a man's life. We're talking about milking the mythology of a real life catastrophe where a person died, for all it's worth, and turning it into this like artistic fantasy fairy tale artifact. Like all of the language here is kind of talking about something out of a fable, or, you know, out of an epic fantasy like Lord of the Rings. And I object to that artifact creating as a central part of eulogizing and mourning a real life human being and trying to turn him mythic. The fact that he himself was trying to turn himself mythic maybe ends up like creating a nice assonance there. But in the end, it's kind of Herzog valuing the myth that he's creating over like the reality of the situation in a way that I find a little exploitative.
Well, I don't agree.
I would argue, this is like slippery territory to get into, but like, you know, Jason kind of opens it up by saying that, you know, Timothy Treadwell himself, you know, kind of turned himself into a mythological character. Like, doesn't it kind of seem like that's how he would want the scene to play out? Like, based on what we see of how he presents on camera and how he tells his own story, like, doesn't it kind of seem like Timothy Treadwell would take a certain pleasure in his final moments being turned so mythological?
No, because he did not want to get eaten by a bear. He wouldn't have wanted that bear shot. It's like it's established he didn't want the bear killed, that he didn't want to vilify bears, that he didn't want people to be afraid of bears. And also all of his self-mythologizing was about how he had cracked the code by becoming a mystical nature warrior who was the only person who understood the bears. Like, I don't think that he would have wanted the tape played or, you know, forced his old love to hear it or anything like that. But I don't think that he would have wanted the creation of this like mythological artifact of his death, you know, by the creatures he thought he understood and controlled, and that he wanted to make sure like nobody feared or mishandled or misused.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a great bit of staging. I mean, Herzog knows how to make movies. I mean, I think it's him telling her that she must not listen to this tape. Is it the most famous moment from the movie? I think his instincts are good, and I think it leads to this dramatic moment where that is also kind of a human moment where he's you know protecting her from this you know truly horrific recording. I don't know. I like it. And I like also Jason's ideas here. The thing of calling it the Excalibur of Timothy's saga, this tape, I thought was really clever. And so I like that. So it's both mythological and human at the same time. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at 3,000 Years of Longing, George Miller's attempt to mine the same fantasies for a more grown-up audience. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, you can take a sniff from the blue rose of forgetfulness and listen to this episode again.